The Movements is a left-wing history and politics podcast. On the last episode, European Jewish intellectuals launch a settler political movement to colonize Palestine and create a refuge from anti-Semitism. But Palestine is already inhabited by Arabs, including Arab Jews and Sephardim, who ask that their European brothers and sisters learn rather than destroy the local culture. Without political control of their own land, Palestinian intellectuals begin to assert themselves and build a modern nationalism of their own. Jewish socialists split over the question of Zionism, as revolutionaries denounce the emergence of Zionism in the movement for rejecting worker internationalism. As more Jews immigrate to Palestine and the Arabs barred from employment, the logical conclusion to the Arab question becomes more and more clear. I now present The Colonization of Palestine, Part 2, A New Jew.
On the wall a soldier stands, keeps the people from their land, and borders tear us all apart, on the ground and in the heart. And while we all must learn...
In the early morning hours of November 28, 1917, Khalil al-Sakakini woke to the sound of mortars emanating from the nearby neighborhood of Mia Shearim. The noise wasn't unusual. Al-Sakakini sat by his nargila and penned a letter explaining that the British were rapidly advancing and seeking to take Jerusalem before Christmas. Shortly after, a Jewish acquaintance of his knocked at the door. Alter Levine was a United States citizen, and thus a national from an enemy nation of the Ottoman Empire. Levine had been avoiding the Turkish authorities for months, moving from home to home and town to town, pursued as a spy. Levine was a traveler with many contacts with foreign diplomats, but unlikely to be engaged in espionage. His family had gone into hiding and his wife tortured into giving his location. Khalil al-Sakakini was confronted with a major decision, whether to give shelter to a fugitive spy and risk implication and torture himself, or to give refuge to a man fleeing persecution. A few years earlier, al-Sakakini had been leading a comfortable life raising his children. He'd been planning the first birthday party for his son Sari when the Ottoman Empire attacked a Russian vessel in the Black Sea, entering the already raging Great War. World War I devastated both the Yishuv and the Palestinian masses. Ottoman authorities, fearing Russian-born Jewish immigrants, hardly scrutinized and expelled some Jewish communities, resulting in an exodus to the United States, reducing the population of Palestine from 85,000 Jews to approximately 50 to 57,000. Palestinians were devastated by disease, Ottoman conscription, and political repression. Lacking support and intervention from Western powers, Palestinians bore the brunt of executions and torture. Many of the local Jews retained citizenship from countries outside of the Ottoman Empire. The situation for the Zionist settlers had become tenuous. Though peacetime relations with the Ottoman Empire had been mixed with immigration restrictions, many thousands had arrived and allowed to establish villages and a Hebrew school network. Now the foreigners were given a choice: accept Ottoman citizenship and join the army, or be deported. Al-Sakakini, knowing he'd likely be arrested and possibly executed, let Mr. Levine into his home and granted him refuge. Israeli historian Tom Segev quotes Sakakini's diary, quote, "I have to say he has granted me a huge honor with his request of sanctuary in my house, because it allows me to represent the spirit of our history and the spirit of our culture. I hope my people will rejoice in a foreigner having requested sanctuary among them and through me, and I have received him in their name after his own people denied him, and his family shut their doors to him." Unquote. Levine likely understood that al-Sakakini would feel obligated to give shelter to the Jew. Al-Sakakini was not close to Mr. Levine, but traditional Arab hospitality won the day. For the next few days, al-Sakakini provided Mr. Levine with food and shelter. Levine, however, would only eat olives and bread, not wanting to eat al-Sakakini's cooking. Sakakini wrote in his diary, quote, "May God forgive you, man. Why shouldn't you eat our food? If you consider our food impure, then we too are impure because we eat impurity. Why then did you ask for sanctuary among us?" Unquote. After a few days, Levine saw an acquaintance outside of the window and called on him to pass a message to his mother-in-law requesting home-cooked meals. Over the next few days, his mother arrived with food in tow. On the third day, so did the police. Arriving at 3 a.m., they pounded on Sacchettini's home entrance while he knocked on Levine's door to wake him, but Levine was fast asleep. Before long, the police broke in and caught both men. They would spend much of the next several months getting to know one another in a Damascus prison. Initially neutral to the European Great War, the Ottoman Empire eventually joined on the side of the Central Powers against the Triple Entente of Britain, France, and Russia. The Ottomans dealt harshly with those suspected of opposing the war effort, banning freedom of the press and utilizing public executions across ethnic and religious lines. Forced relocation and food shortages devastated the entire population even before the arrival of the British in 1917. Prior to the campaign to take Palestine, the British engaged in secret negotiations with both Arabs and Zionists, negotiations which would have serious repercussions. Following the collapse of Ottoman resistance and the establishment of British rule, the Zionist movement was quick to provide relief to the Jewish community ravaged by the ongoing conflict. This relief effort formed the first seeds of a state apparatus. The Zionist Commission, formed towards the end of the war in 1918, was the first proto-government of the Yishuv, mainly comprised British and Western European Zionist Jews. The Zionist Commission was tasked with studying conditions on the ground in Palestine, reporting them to the British with recommendations, and eventually conducting diplomacy on behalf of the Yishuv. Describing the relationship between the old Yishuv community in Jerusalem and the Zionist Commission, Israeli historian Tom Segev writes, quote, "Most of the Jews in Jerusalem had always lived off the donations they received from the Jewish communities in Europe. This was the Halakha system. The Jews were meant to represent their European communities in Jerusalem and engage in Torah study and prayer in their names. Most of them had no independent income, and since the war had lived without any income at all. The Zionist Commission functioned as a direct successor of the Halakha system, providing a daily bread ration to more than 1,000 elderly Jews, 7,000 students, 800 invalids, and 1,500 orphans. The willingness of Jerusalem's ultra-Orthodox community had long scorned the Zionist movement. The personal dependency of many in the community worked to strengthen the Zionist position. Weizmann even tried to impose a condition on the ultra-Orthodox yeshivas: financial support in return for conducting studies in Hebrew rather than in Yiddish, though with little success. He also tried to intervene in local politics, but he failed in his effort. Nothing had prepared him for that kind of tangle." Unquote. The Jewish politics of Palestine at this time were not sectarian, at least not in a strictly delineated sense. Nor would the tension between Ashkenazi Jews and the Mizrahim and Sephardim, or between the secular and religious, fully subside, just as the non-Jewish Palestinian Arabs would disagree and bicker among themselves. The influx of Zionist Jews would have a profound effect on the lives of the indigenous Jewish population, largely Arabic-speaking and immersed in Arab culture. Politics also made for odd bedfellows. While earlier Zionist efforts to influence Ottoman authorities were met with mixed success, the victory of the British in Palestine was a major political victory for the Zionist movement as well. However, British support for the Zionist project was not monolithic, nor was it necessarily based on an affinity for Jews. Chaim Weizmann, the chief diplomat and representative of the Zionist movement in Europe, met with and sought the support of anyone who could be convinced that support for Zionism was in their self-interest. Writing of David Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister from 1916 to 1922, Tom Segev writes, quote, "Weizmann's principal achievement was to create among British leaders an identity between the Zionist movement and world Jewry. Lloyd George referred to the Jewish race, world Jewry, and the Zionists as if these were synonyms. He also succeeded in persuading them that British and Zionist interests were the same. Yet none of it was true. No real national interest dictated support for Zionism. Moreover, the movement that was supposed to be the center of world influence, in fact occupied four small dark rooms in Piccadilly Circus in London. Its entire archives were kept in a single box in a small hotel room under the bed of Nahum Sokolow, a leader of the World Zionist Organization. Unquote. British anti-Semitism also embraced the Jewish Bolshevism conspiracy theory, which tied red baiting and anxiety of world revolution with the worldwide Jewish conspiracy. According to this belief, the Bolsheviks of Russia and their sympathizers worldwide were organized, funded, and following orders from a secret cabal of international Jews. A version of this theory would later become a staple of Nazi and neo-Nazi mythology. While British anti-Semites were not monolithic in their attitudes towards Jews, those with power and influence, including the Prime Minister, decided that if Jews controlled the world and pulled the strings of key world governments, it would be in their best interest to be on the Jews' good side. The war hadn't yet ended, and while the Bolsheviks in Russia advocated an immediate end to the war, Lloyd George supported the creation of a Jewish legion to take part in the fighting in Palestine to encourage world Jewry to support British war efforts. While the Jewish Legion never saw combat in Palestine, this was one of several diplomatic victories achieved with a dose of strategic anti-Semitism. When Louis Brandeis, a friend of Chaim Weizmann, convinced Woodrow Wilson to support the Balfour Declaration, a matter he cared for very little, Lloyd George became ever more convinced in his belief that the White House was controlled by Jews. Unquote. As the gradually increasing settler population continued to build their proto-state and dispossess Palestinians from employment or residence, organized resistance, both violent and nonviolent, began to emerge. By the end of the First World War, the Arab elite was forced to respond to the growing tension, generally adopting the grievances of Palestinian peasants while becoming increasingly aware of the political aspirations of this generation of Zionist immigrants, with its new focus on the assertive New Jew, who spoke of a national home. Speaking in the years preceding World War I, a Palestinian member of the Ottoman Chamber of Deputies, Said Bey al-Husseini of Jerusalem, warned of Zionist expansionism. Morris writes, quote, Husseini warned that the Zionists were bent on establishing a Jewish state extending from Palestine to Syria and Iraq. Husseini was not mapping prospective Zionist geography out of thin air. Spokesmen for the movement had declared or implied that Zionism's aim was a Jewish state stretching eastward as far as the Euphrates, referred to in the Bible as the eastern boundary of the Promised Land. Max Nordau, for example, said the Zionists were coming to the land of Israel, quote, to expand Europe's moral borders to the Euphrates, unquote. Today, the political realities render the possibility of an Israel beyond the Jordan River more or less inconceivable, though the Israeli right wing absolutely still harbors aspirations to annex the West Bank and Gaza. The question of what constitutes the borders of Israel, or in those days, the aspirational borders of a future Jewish state, led to many arguments, accusations, and splits over the answer. At different points, Zionists denied their intent to establish a state. At others, they differed amongst themselves on the extent of borders while fending off accusations of expansionism. Establishing a Jewish state stretching all the way to the Euphrates would have been a difficult goal. However, Arab fears of colonization and displacement were not without foundation. Nearby Egypt had been wrested by the British from Ottoman control in 1882. Despite British promises of Arab independence in exchange for taking up arms against the Ottomans at the end of World War I, much of the Ottoman Middle East was partitioned into British and French protectorates. While Zionism was its own independent settler colonial project rather than a simple extension of European imperialism, the strategy of Zionism after 1897 required the support of the major powers for political expediency and legitimacy. First the Ottomans, then the United Kingdom. While the proto-state of the Yishuv would maintain independence, it would link its own interests with that of whichever major power was willing to collaborate. As future founder of the revisionist Zionist movement, Zev Jabotinsky put it, quote, if there is one output on the Mediterranean shore in which Europe has a chance of holding fast, it is Palestine, but Palestine with a Jewish majority. Unquote. The Zionist mainstream, ethnocentric and nationalist despite its nominally socialist ideological outlook, adopted a naive expectation that the Palestinian peasants could be convinced to leave their ancestral lands for other Arab communities. This naive approach reasoned that if the indigenous population would not respond reasonably to incentives offered by the Zionist leadership, more coercive measures would be taken. In Image and Reality of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, Professor Norman Finkelstein quotes a number of early Zionist thinkers to illustrate the Zionist claim to Palestinian lands. Quote, "The cultural Zionist Ahad Ham was, in Gorney's words, firm in his insistence that both the peoples and Palestine be treated justly, but he saw the historical rights of the Jews outweighing the Arabs' residential rights in Palestine. Max Nordau declared that Palestine was the legal and historical inheritance of the Jewish nation, of which they were robbed 1,900 years ago by the Roman aggressors. The Palestinian Arabs had only possession rights. Jabotinsky asserted that since the Arab nation incorporated large stretches of land, it would be an act of justice to requisition Palestine in order to make a home for a wandering people. The Palestinian Arabs would still have a place to call their own. Indeed, of fully nine countries to the east and west of the Suez." Chaim Weizmann, president of the Zionist organization and later first president of Israel, remarked in 1930, quote, "There can be no conceivable hardship for Palestinian Arabs, a nomadic and semi-nomadic people, to move to another Arab country where there are better opportunities for an agricultural life." Unquote. The schism between the European Zionists and Arab or Sephardic Jews grew and strained as well. Despite the latter's wish to integrate their European siblings into the local culture, the mainstream of Zionists continued to consider their non-European brethren as inferior. Mordechai ben Hillel HaCohen, Hebrew writer and a founder of Tel Aviv, considered local Jews Levantine like the Arabs. He wrote of the indigenous population, quote, "The great majority of the country's residents are fellahs and Bedouin, all of them wild, whom world culture has still not reached. It will be a long time before they can learn to live lives in which there is no robbery, thievery, and larceny, lives in which they feel shame and embarrassment at walking around half-naked and barefoot, lives of possessions and property and established boundaries, lives in which there is a need for level sidewalks and paved roads, organized schools and charitable institutions, courts without bribery, and so on." Unquote. Elsewhere, HaCohen would praise the British as cultural allies. Quote, "England will come to establish a government in Palestine and will link us with Europe." Unquote. Teacher and author Ahron Avraham Kabak wrote of Yemenite Jews in similarly harsh terms. Quote, "The Yemenite child, after so many generations of idleness, penury, abjectness, and servility under the fierce Yemenite sun, brings with him, together with Oriental sharp-wittedness and williness, a tendency for delusion, negligence, slowness of movements, with bodily lethargy and weakness of the nerves." Unquote. Zev Jabotinsky wrote, quote, "We Jews have nothing in common with what is called the Orient, thank God. To the extent that our uneducated masses have ancient spiritual traditions and laws that recall the Orient, they must be weaned away from them. And this is in fact what we are doing in every decent school, and what life itself is doing with great success." Unquote. The influx of increasingly militant Jewish immigrants from Tsarist Russia led to the development of a more hardline Zionism. The aforementioned Zev Jabotinsky, previously a Jewish resistance organizer in Tsarist Russia, would found the right-wing Zionist opposition known as Revisionist Zionism. Hardened by years of life under the anti-Semitic Russian sphere, Jabotinsky rejected the left-wing pretense of establishing a Jewish majority and compliant passive Palestinian acquiescence. Quote, "A voluntary agreement between us and the Arabs of Palestine is inconceivable now or in the foreseeable future, precisely because they are not a mob, but a living nation." Unquote. While this might conflict with Jabotinsky's earlier assertion that the Palestinian Arabs would resettle in any number of other Arab lands, it demonstrated his expectation that the Palestinian Arabs would resist their displacement. Zionist rhetoric began to take a harder edge. Quote, Settlement can only develop under the protection of a force which is not dependent on the local population, behind an iron wall which they will be powerless to break down. Unquote. World War I saw Britain take its place as the force, the iron wall that Jabotinsky spoke of. In secret, Britain signed a secret agreement with France in order to divide the Arab lands previously ruled by the Ottomans. These mandates, as they were called, were seen by the Arab elites as colonies by another name. At the same time, the Balfour Declaration, an official statement of British policy as favorable towards the creation of a national home for Jews, became the long-sought certificate of legitimacy for the Zionist project. Quote, His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Unquote. The Arab elites, who in mid-1916 had taken up arms with the British against the Ottomans in order to hasten the process of establishing independence, instead slowly realized that they had traded one empire for another. To them, the Zionists were European settlers who were now one step closer towards establishing a state on Arab lands. Palestinian Arabs were slow in their official response, but felt similarly. Benny Morris writes, quote, In Palestine, reactions were muted. It was only a full year later, in November 1918, that about 100 Arab dignitaries and representatives of political cultural associations addressed a petition to the British denouncing the declaration. A uniquely empathetic document in Palestinian Arab terms, it stated that they had always sympathized profoundly with the persecuted Jews and their misfortunes in other countries. But there is a wide difference between this sympathy and the acceptance of such a nation ruling over us and disposing of our affairs. Unquote. In October 1917, shortly before the Balfour Declaration, the newly established Bolshevik government in Russia leaked documents to the Manchester Guardian detailing the previously secret agreement to divide Ottoman territory. After the war ended, the borders of the British Mandate of Palestine, as well as modern-day Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, were drawn up by European powers, borders whose consequences are still being felt today. In the wake of the successful British invasion and Arab uprising, the British and later French made their moves to establish not colonies, but mandates and protectorates. The newly created League of Nations granted the British a mandate in Palestine. The British mandate, on paper a guardianship which could be revoked by the League of Nations, was a colony all in name. The British had made conflicting promises to both the Zionists and the Arab nationalists before the end of the war. In reality, Palestine would be under military rule for 2 years and under British civil administration thereafter, exacerbating both the tensions between Zionist and Arab nationalists and turning them against their colonial overlords. Initially, the Arab elite believed that the arrival of the British would lead to Arab independence. The Arabic press reflourished after years of Ottoman censorship, and civic organizations allowed larger numbers of Palestinian Arabs to debate, study, and articulate their visions for Arab nationalism. In May 1919, the Jaffa chapter of the Muslim Christian Association held a public forum to discuss the future of Palestine. Over 500 residents from Jaffa and nearby villages attended. Records from the meeting describe a Christian and Muslim Jewish Arab nationalism, which recognized the equality for Jews, differentiating between Judaism and Zionism. Tom Segev quotes one speaker, quote, We do not at all oppose the Jews. We only oppose Zionism. That is not the same thing. Zionism has no roots at all in Moses' law. It is an invention of Herzl's. Unquote. The general line opposed Zionism and unrestricted Jewish immigration, though some speakers called attention to anti-Zionist Jews and welcomed immigration of Jews who harbored no separatist sentiments. At the end of the meeting, a resolution was presented declaring Palestine a part of Syria, though calling for autonomy as part of a greater Syria. However, the meeting dissolved into rabble and shoving when it was suggested that all attendees sign their names under the statement. For their part, Zionists attempted to come to an understanding regarding Palestine with Arab elites. Quote, In early 1918, with only half of Palestine in British hands, London took steps designed to begin implementing the Balfour Declaration. A 9-man Zionist commission headed by Weizmann and chaperoned by Ormsby Gore was dispatched to Palestine to chart the way. Soon after his arrival, Weizmann set out via the Suez Canal and Aqaba by boat and then on camelback to meet Faisal, whose army was encamped in Wadi Wahida near Man in southern Transjordan. Weizmann had hardly bothered to meet with the Palestinian Arab notables. As a group, he held them to be dishonest, uneducated, greedy, and unpatriotic. The Hashemites were something else. Unquote. Weizmann regarded Faisal as a truly urbane, educated equal, possibly persuaded by his distrust of Palestinian Arabs. By February 1919, they came to agreements allowing increased Jewish immigration to Palestine and protections for Arab inhabitants and their property. Initially, Faisal appealed to the British for an independent Arab state, excluding Palestine. But by 1920, a year before his removal by the French, Faisal would advocate Palestine's inclusion in the independent Arab state. That year, the Western powers agreed to hand over control of Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine, Iraq, to the French and British, respectively. Arabs felt betrayed, and the British themselves harbored a particularly racist and classist attitude towards Palestinian Arabs. Meanwhile, the British, whose Red Scare anti-Semitism associated Jewry with Russian Bolshevism, both fearing Arab enmity and Bolshevik infiltrators, limited Jewish immigration. The Zionists were also experiencing financial troubles, and the optimism brought by the Balfour Declaration began to wane. While the British ruled as they pleased, eventually establishing the final borders that would become modern-day Israel and Palestine, the Zionists and Arab elites outside of Palestine negotiated, bickered, and attempted in vain to come to some sort of negotiated settlement to satisfy both nationalisms. This proved impossible. The mainstream Zionist current sought a Jewish state with a Jewish majority, though they were careful about stating this much openly within Arab ears. The Arab nationalists, both Palestinian and those from outside the Mandate, were generally open to allowing some or all settled Jews to remain in Palestine. However, they were adamantly against statehood and wary of continued immigration, however limited. Both of these national movements tolerated the British administration for the time being. With the war's end came relative stability, British infrastructure, and an improved economy. But the coming decades would see organized violence against the European power, as well as a parallel spike in violence between Zionists and anti-Zionists. Within a couple of years, the first anti-Zionist riots and mob attacks on Jewish communities would begin. Historian Benny Morris likened these incidents of violence that began in the early 1920s as unprecedented for centuries in Palestine. While self-defense organizations had existed previously, the 1920s also saw the emergence of the Haganah, a Jewish militia that would evolve into the proto-national army of the Yishuv and eventually the Israel Defense Forces. The Palestinians, lacking the centralized organization and political maturity to create a relatively structured militia, created short-lived, small, secret militias and guerrilla groups. While negotiations occurred abroad, the continued dispossession of Palestinian Arabs from their ancestral lands continued at the hands of Zionist settlers using money from abroad. The doctrine of Hebrew labor, as well as general economic trends, led to an exodus of Fellahin from the rural areas to the cities. The recently proletarianized Arab wage workers endured difficult economic conditions, despite the improved economy after the war. During the year prior to the riots, relations between Jews and non-Jewish Arabs began to deteriorate. In 1919, a meeting between Meir Husseini of Jerusalem and recently appointed head of the Zionist Commission, Menachem Ushishkin, demonstrated the growing tensions. Describing the differences between Ushishkin and his predecessor David Eder, Tom Segev writes, quote, "The two had little in common. Eder was very British, Ushishkin very Russian. Eder was quiet, Ushishkin loquacious. Eder was temperate, almost inconspicuous, while Ushishkin was bombastic, insistent on getting respect he thought was his due." Eder believed the success of Zionism depended on working with restraint and avoiding flagrant spectacles so as to not aggravate the Arab population. Ushishkin believed in large demonstrations of national pride. Inevitably, his introductory meeting with the mayor was hostile from the start, and it quickly deteriorated into explicit talk of war. Unquote. Aside from arguments over potholes and infrastructure funds, their conversation turned particularly heated when the subject of the Paris peace talks, the post-World War I negotiations that decided the fate of much of the world's population, including that of Palestine. Ushishkin argued that both the world powers and Faisal had consented to a Jewish national home in Palestine. Husseini responded that Palestinian Arabs had not consented to Faisal conceding on their behalf. To Husseini, Jews already in Palestine were welcome to stay, but immigration had to be halted and the Zionists had to respect Arab culture, which he believed they did not understand. Ushishkin had conceded that Zionists had caused Arabs harm, but warned that there would be no compromise on national demands. Tom Segev writes, "We do not want war," he went on. "In fact, we are doing everything to prevent war. Yet the Jews are not afraid of war," he said, "if it is necessary." And His Excellency knew, Ushishkin told the mayor, that Jews were currently equipped with everything needed for war. A war would hurt both sides, but the Arabs would suffer more, he concluded. Unquote. After the meeting, Ushishkin reported to the commission that Husseini was an enemy of the Jewish people. In the year preceding the Nebi Musa celebration of 1920, Jews felt an increasing sense of danger. Occasional fits of violence occurred in the weeks leading up to the April celebration, taking on an increasingly vicious and sectarian nature. During a March 8th demonstration, Jews were assaulted and chants were heard with the words, quote, "Palestine is our land and the Jews are our dogs," and, quote, "Kill the Jews," unquote. Zionist leaders had repeatedly demanded that the British authorities increase security during the April celebrations. The British ignored these concerns on the grounds that the previous year's Nebi Musa passed without incident. Zev Jabotinsky, writing to Chaim Weizmann on March 12th, stated that the, quote, "pogrom is liable to break out here any day," unquote. On April 4th, a procession of 600 pilgrims from Hebron entered Jerusalem. Many of the pilgrims carried placards and shouted slogans such as, quote, "Shall we give the country to a people who crucified our Lord Jesus?" unquote. As the procession-turned rally ended, violence erupted. The following rampage saw Jews stoned and Jewish shops looted. Arab police stood by or even participated in the riots, while the British response was slow. Indian troops were eventually dispatched to the Jewish quarter, but then recalled by the British that night. The following morning, the riots resumed. Members of the Haganah, the recently formed Jewish militia, were prevented from entering the Jewish quarter by the British on multiple occasions. Benny Morris describes the toll of 3 days of violence. Quote, "The 3 days of rioting resembled nothing more than a pogrom. Nothing like it had been seen in Palestine during the centuries of Ottoman rule. The Arab mob, sensing the atmosphere in Government House, had shouted, 'Al-Dawla Ma'ana,' the government is with us." In a number of cases, Arabs protected their Jewish neighbors, but 6 Jews were killed, a number raped, and more than 200 injured. And much property, including several synagogues, were destroyed. Several Arabs were also killed and dozens injured by British troops and police and by Jewish defenders. Unquote. No Jews died in Jewish West Jerusalem, which was patrolled by the Haganah, organized in part by Zev Jabotinsky, along with veterans of the Jewish Legion and HaShomer, the Jewish security patrol. At the time of the riots, the Haganah consisted of approximately 200 members armed with 50 rifles and a small number of pistols and grenades. The British would arrest Jabotinsky along with other Zionists and Palestinian Arabs. By July 8th, a general amnesty from the British would free all the Palestinians convicted or sought for arrest, including Haj Amin al-Husseini, who had fled Palestine following his participation in the riots. By 1921, Husseini would be installed by the British as Grand Mufti of Jerusalem after a fraudulent election in which he came fourth. The results were ignored and he was appointed by High Commissioner Herbert Samuels on May 8, 1921. A week before this appointment, another riot had broken out in Jaffa, even worse than the previous year's riots in Jerusalem. The ancient port city, known internationally for its famous Jaffa oranges, was the site of 2 rival demonstrations, not between Zionist Jews and Palestinian Arabs, but between the Jewish Socialist Workers' Party, the precursor to the Palestine Communist Party, and the Labour Party known as Ahdut HaAvodah. The communists being unauthorized in their rally while the labor activists sanction in theirs, the police chased the communists into the crowd of Palestinian Arabs who were no fans of the Bolshevik sympathizing communists. Accounts are hazy as to what exactly sparked the riot, but attacks on Jews were the result. That day, a hotel housing Jewish immigrants was attacked by a mob with Arab police participation. 13 Jews were killed and 26 injured by gunfires, stabbings, and bludgeonings. Not until May 3rd, 2 days into the wave of violence and looting, did the British impose martial law. The riots would continue until May 7th, with violence spreading to other communities. Tom Segev writes, quote, "In testimony reminiscent of the Nebi Musa riots of the previous year, many witnesses recounted how the mob had torn apart quilts and pillows and scattered the down in the alleys, just as Russian thugs did during the pogroms. The Commission of Inquiry later described the riots as an orgy of pillage. Many witnesses identified their neighbors amongst the attackers and murderers. In some places, Arabs had come to the defense of Jews and gave them refuge in their homes." Unquote. Jewish self-defense was less effective than they had been in Jerusalem during the Nebi Musa riots the previous year. In one case, armed Jews opted for revenge attacks against Palestinian Arab communities in Jaffa. Segev writes, quote, "By late afternoon, the news from Jaffa had reached the Sarafan military camp about 12 miles away. The Jewish Legion, which no longer existed but had not yet been officially disbanded, was billeted at the camp and several soldiers set out in the direction of the riots. Wyndham Deeds, who was kept apprised of the situation, agreed the men should be given rifles. In addition, Pinhas Rutenberg, Jabotinsky's partner in the Jerusalem self-defense efforts, had arrived in Tel Aviv and was helping the Jews organize. The next morning, armed Jews went into the streets of Jaffa to take revenge. Arab accounts of the Jewish violence are very similar to the Jewish testimonies about Arab riots. The Jews looted homes and stores. They broke into Arab houses, beating and killing the occupants. In one house, a woman and child were murdered. A hunchbacked Arab and his children were killed in an orange grove. Their bodies were disfigured. A Jewish policeman took part." Unquote. After nearly a week of violence and eventually British bombing of Arab rioters from the air, 47 Jews, 48 Arabs were dead, with 146 Jews and 73 Arabs wounded. In 1922, an American newspaper published a report from the King Crane Commission, an American investigation team appointed by Woodrow Wilson, which had spent 3 weeks in the Middle East surveying public opinion before presenting their findings in August 1919. Based upon the principles of self-determination as articulated by Woodrow Wilson during World War I, the report found that nearly 90% of Palestine opposed the establishment of a Jewish state. It also came to the conclusion that a Jewish state would not be viable without an armed conflict to establish one, stating that the commissioners began their study of Zionism with minds predisposed in its favor. The report stated that the Zionist program needed to be significantly modified. Quoting the report, quote, "For a national home of the Jewish people is not equivalent to making Palestine into a Jewish state, nor can the erection of such a Jewish state be accomplished without the gravest trespass upon the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. The fact came out repeatedly in the Commission's conference with Jewish representatives, and the Zionists looked forward to a practically complete dispossession of the present non-Jewish inhabitants of Palestine by various forms of purchase." Unquote. The survey also found that, given a choice over which power was to act as a temporary steward towards independence, the United States was the preferred power over Britain and France. Among the report's two most interesting recommendations was a Jewish home with continued Jewish immigration, but without the establishment of a Jewish state, and the establishment of a single Syrian mandate under the United States. The Zionist position was firmly against U.S. involvement in Palestine, for fear that the right to self-determination would interfere with the goals of a Jewish state. Tom Segev quotes a publication by the Zionist organization in London. Quote, "American democracy too commonly means majority rule without regard to diversities of types or stages of civilization of differences of quality. Democracy in that sense has been called the melting pot, in which that quantitatively lesser is assimilated into the quantitatively greater. This doubtless is natural in America and works on the whole very well. But if the American idea were applied as an American administration might apply it to Palestine, what would happen? The numerical majority in Palestine today is Arab, not Jewish. Qualitatively, it is a simple fact that the Jews are now predominant in Palestine, and given proper conditions, they will be predominant quantitatively also in a generation or two. But if the crude arithmetical conception of democracy were to be applied now or at some early stage in the future to Palestinian conditions, the majority that would rule would be the Arab majority, and the task of establishing and developing a great Jewish Palestine would be infinitely more difficult. Unquote. In the final months of the Great War, Alter Levine and Khalil al-Sakakini continued to get to know one another in a Damascus prison, having been arrested the final day of Ottoman rule in Jerusalem. Both men kept diaries and described a growing, though complicated, friendship with the other. Levine himself felt guilty for his carelessness, having gotten al-Sakakini caught. Sakakini described Levine as a friend, though he wrote of frustration at Levine's perceived arrogance as a member of the chosen people. Sakakini conceded that Levine likely viewed himself as similarly arrogant and lamented, quote, "I do not understand him, and he does not understand me," unquote. Levine, on the other hand, fetishized his Arab friend, having become fascinated with Arab culture. He even described dressing himself in Arab clothing and admiring himself in private. He was attracted to the Arab stereotype, as Tom Segev describes, quote, "a noble savage, romantic, erotic, and cruel," unquote. Sakakini enjoyed support from intellectuals and was released early in January of 1918. He would return to prison to visit Alter Levine until the latter's release in April 1918, thanks to outside pressure from a local diplomat. Levine stayed with Sakakini and his friends in Damascus before the latter departed to join Faisal's revolt against the Ottomans. The two friends would quickly return to Jerusalem and maintain friendly contact, though their political differences grew. Sakakini would become an important figure and diarist of the emerging Arab and Palestinian national movements. He would advocate for the mandate of Palestine to be granted to the United States. Speaking to Ronald Storrs, then military governor of Jerusalem, Khalil al-Sakakini described Arab opinion on the future rulers of Palestine and beyond. Tom Segev quotes, quote, "I will not conceal from you that nearly the entire public wishes the mandate to be given to the U.S. because they have seen that England promised to give the Jews Palestine as a national home. They have also seen how the English act in the country. They encourage the Zionist movement. We want the country to be under the sponsorship of a single power, and so we will preserve our unity. The country that saves us from Zionism and from partition, that country we will prefer above all others." Unquote. In his diaries, Sakakini recognized that Palestine had no control over its political future, and that the Americans were not interested enough to intervene. The British would ignore Sakakini's recommendation as they would ignore the recommendation of the King Crane Commission. While the next 8 years would be relatively calm in Palestine, the damage done during the 1920 and 1921 riots went beyond death and property destruction. For the Zionists and Jews, the minority positions of binationalism and other forms of coexistence with Palestinians became that much more marginalized, giving way to an increasingly militant and separatist Zionist mainstream. This trend could be seen in the development of the kibbutzim, nominally socialist agricultural collectives of Jews on the frontiers of Palestine. While only 2.5% of Jews at the end of 1920, the settlers of the kibbutzim became national and historic symbols, a pillar of the foundational myth of rugged settlers conquering the barren wilderness. In reality, these settlements were economically unfeasible and heavily subsidized. Periodically, some members would abandon the kibbutzim due to the hardship and austere lifestyle. Paradoxically, these collectives that prided themselves on equality of sexes and no class distinctions were also ethnically homogenous and segregated. Rather than socialist paradises on the frontier, these settlements primarily served as frontline militia outposts for the settler colonial project of Zionism. Yigal Alon would describe the early importance of the kibbutzim to the development of the pre-Israel armed forces of the Yishuv. Quote, "The planning and development of pioneering Zionists were from the start at least partly determined by political strategic needs. The choice of the location of the settlements, for instance, was influenced not only by considerations of economic viability, and also even chiefly by the needs of local defense, overall settlement strategy, and by the role such blocks of settlement might play in some future, perhaps decisive, all-out struggle. Accordingly, land was purchased, or more often reclaimed, in remote parts of the country. Unquote. Agricultural settlements, whether left-wing, kibbutzim, or general moshavot, were generally the forefront of the Zionist struggle, and part of the ideological development of the aforementioned New Jew. Segev writes, quote, "The image of the ideal pioneer was largely congruent with the image of the new man, supposedly being created in Palestine. He appears on period posters and in photographs as a muscular, light-haired, joyous youth. The ideal was part of the Zionist movement from its beginnings. Max Nordau was famous for his call for a revival of muscular Judaism. Arthur Rubin praised the pioneers as members of a, quote, new Jewish race. Zev Jabotinsky said, there is a need to create a new Jewish frame of mind. I am almost prepared to say a new psychological race of Jews. Ben-Gurion dreamed of a new type of Jew who will be an exemplar for tourists. The inspiration for this ideal came largely from the Soviet Union, but also from Weimar Germany and fascist Italy." Unquote. The new Jew was rugged, assertive, and anti-intellectual in its ideology. Moshe Smolansky lamented the influx of immigrants poisoning the air with their lazy tendencies. Writing for Haaretz, he wrote, quote, "There is space in Palestine for 1,000 philosophers. No more, no more. The rest, if they wanted to live and build, need not a mind but a pair of hands." Unquote. One Zionist ideologue wrote with indignance, quote, "One farmer bought a piano." Unquote. HaCohen would soon become one of the most prominent supporters of the Battalion for the Defense of the Language, a small but notorious student organization founded to establish Hebrew as the sole language of Jews. Their initial activities included protesting against Jewish lecturers speaking in Yiddish, German, or any number of other languages. The young, brash, and ideological were drawn into its ranks, as membership proved an avenue of social mobility and respect amongst the Zionist political elite. As branches spread throughout Palestine, they became more militant. Though the violence never rose above the level of harassment and threats, their activities ranged from threatening letter campaigns to even the use of a stink bomb during a lecture by a prominent Yiddishist. During film screenings, members would throw ink and rotten eggs at the screens. Many Jews were disturbed by the national chauvinism of the movement, with the Yiddish press particularly enraged. In 1922, Ellis Kaduri, an Iraqi Jewish millionaire, passed away and willed £100,000 to the British government for educational development in Palestine or Iraq, of their choosing. With no indication that the money was intended for Hebrew education, the Zionist organization and prominent Yishuv politicians lobbied the government to invest in a Hebrew education in Palestine. The director of the Education Department of Jerusalem proposed that the money be used to found an elite public school for Jewish and Arab boys under the British model, teaching both Hebrew and Arabic at the lower level and English at the upper school. The Zionist movement opposed the plan vehemently and lobbied against it. Tom Segev writes, quote, "The government gave in. An academic high school would be established for the Jews, together with a separate agricultural school for the Arabs, the assumption being that the Arabs did not need the sort of instruction that would prepare them for college. The Zionist organization agreed to this at first, but then issued a demand to set up an agricultural school for Jews as well, lest anyone think their foothold in the land of their fathers was weaker than of the Arabs." Unquote. The Zionist movement achieved their goal of segregation, as they were granted their own agricultural school separate from Arabs, as well as an academic school solely for Jews. While the public position presented by mainstream Zionism continued to underplay Zionist aspirations within the Mandate and beyond, rhetoric claiming that Arabs and Jews were not in national conflict appeared increasingly false. Humphrey Bowman, the director of the Department of Education, would lament the lost moment in his memoirs. Quote, "Here was an opportunity of bringing Jews and Arabs together on common ground." unquote.
يا طالي عين عين للجبل يا مول المقيدين النار بين اليمن يمن عين للهنا يا روح.
The Movements is a left-wing history podcast. Music by Daniel Kahn and Pasoy Korolenko, Oi Division, and Reem Bana. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Support the show at paypal.me/movementspodcast. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Movements Pod. Weissmann had hardly bothered to meet with the Palestinian Arab notables. As a group, he held them to be dishonest, uneducated, greedy, and unpatriotic. The Hashemites were something else. Weissmann regarded Faisal as a truly urbane, educated equal, possibly persuaded by his distrust of Palestinian Arabs. They came to agreements allowing increased Jewish immigration to Palestine and protections for Arab inhabitants and their property.